Part 2. Paradise Lost. Chapter 7. Searching for Soma, the Golden Vedic Enigma. Our present global crisis is more profound than any previous historical crises, hence our solutions must be more drastic. Plants and a renewal of our archaic relationship with plants could serve as the organizational model for life in the 21st century, just as the computer operates as the dominant model of the late 20th century. We need to think back to the last sane moment that we as a species ever knew, and then act from the premises that were in place at that moment. This means reaching back in time to models that were successful 15,000 to 20,000 years ago. This shift in viewpoint would enable us to see plants as more than food, shelter, clothing, or even sources of education and religion. They would become models of process. They are, after all, the exemplars of symbiotic connectedness and efficient resource recycling and management. If we acknowledge that archaic revival will be a paradigm transformation and that we really can create a caring, refeminized, eco-sensitive world by going back to very old models, then we must admit that more than political exhortation will be needed. To be effective, the archaic revival must rest on an experience that shakes each and every one of us to our very roots. The experience must be real, generalized, and discussable. We can begin this restructuring of thought by declaring legitimate what we have denied for so long. Let us declare nature to be legitimate. The notion of illegal plants is obnoxious and ridiculous in the first place. Contacting the mind behind nature. The last best hope for dissolving the steep walls of cultural inflexibility that appear to be channeling us toward true ruin is a renewed shamanism. By re-establishing channels of direct communication with the other, the mind behind nature, through the use of hallucinogenic plants, we will obtain a new set of lenses to see our way in the world. When the medieval world grew moribund in its worldview, secularized European society sought salvation in the revivifying of classical Greek and Roman approaches to law, philosophy, aesthetics, city planning, and agriculture. Our dilemma being deeper will cast us further back into time in a search for answers. We need to examine the visionary intoxicants of our collective past, which include the strange cult of Soma, described in the earliest Indo-European spiritual writings. No history of plants and peoples could claim completeness without a thorough treatment of the mysterious Soma cult of the ancient Indo-Europeans. As mentioned in Chapter 6, the Indo-Europeans were a nomadic people whose original home has been a matter of scholarly debate and who are associated with patriarchy, wheeled chariots, and the domestication of the horse. Also associated with the Indo-Europeans is a religion based on the magnificently intoxicating Soma. Soma was a juice or sap pressed out of the swollen fibers of a plant that was also called Soma. The texts seem to imply that the juice was purified by being poured through a woolen filter, and then in some cases was mixed with milk. Again and again and in various ways, we find Soma intimately connected with the symbolism and rituals related to cattle and pastoralism. As will be discussed, the identity of Soma is not known. We believe this connection to cattle is central to any attempt to identify Soma. The earliest scriptural writings of these Indo-European people are the Vedas. Of these, the best known is the Rig Veda, best described as a collection of nearly 120 hymns to Soma, the plant and the god. Indeed, the ninth mandala of the Rig Veda is entirely composed of a paean of praise for the magical plant. The beginning of the ninth mandala is typical of the praises of Soma that pervade and typify Indo-European literature of the period. Thy juices, purified Soma, all-pervading, swift as thought, go of themselves like the offspring of swift mares, the celestial, well-winged, sweet-flavored juices, great exciters of exhilaration, alight upon the receptacle. Thy exhilarating all-pervading juices are let loose separately like chariot horses. The sweet-flavored Soma waves go to Indra the wielder of the thunderbolt as a cow with milk to the calf. Like a horse urged on to do battle, do thou who art all-knowing rush from heaven to the receptacle whose mother is the cloud. Purified Soma, thy celestial steed-like streams as quick as thought are pouring along with the milk into the receptacle. The Rishis, the ordainers of sacrifice, who cleanse thee, O Rishi, enjoyed Soma, pour thy continuous streams into the midst of the vessel. Soma was prominent in the pre-Zoroastrian religion of Iran as Heoma. Soma and Heoma are different forms of the same word, derived from a root meaning to squeeze out liquid, which is su in Sanskrit and hu in Avestan. No praise seems to have been too excessive to be applied to the magical intoxicant. Soma was thought to have been brought by an eagle from the highest heaven, or from the mountains where it had been placed by Varuna, a member of the early Hindu pantheon. Here is another quote from Rig Veda. It is drunk by the sick man as medicine at sunrise. Partaking of it strengthens the limbs, preserves the legs from breaking, wards off all disease, and lengthens life. Then need and trouble vanish away. Pinching want is driven off and flees when the inspiring one lays hold of the mortal. The poor man, in the intoxication of the soma, feels himself rich. The draught impels the singer to lift his voice and inspires him for song. It gives the poet supernatural power, so that he feels himself immortal. On account of this inspiring power of the drink, there arose even in the Indo-Iranian period a personification of the sap as the god Soma, and ascription to him of almost all the deeds of other gods, the strength of the gods even being increased by this draught. Like Agni, Soma causes his radiance to shine cheeringly in the waters. Like Vayu, he drives on with his steeds. Like the Akvins, he comes in haste with aid when summoned. Like Pusan, he excites reverence, watches over the herds, and leads by the shortest roads to success. Like Indra, as the sought-for ally, he overcomes all enemies near and far, frees from the evil intentions of the envious, from danger and want, brings goodly riches from heaven, from earth and the air. Soma too makes the sun rise in the heavens, restores what has been lost, has a thousand ways and means of help, heals all, blind and lame, chases away the black skin, aborigines, and gives everything into the possession of the pious Arya. In his, the world ruler's, ordinances these lands stand. He, the bearer of heaven and the prop of earth, holds all people in his hand. Bright shining as Maitra, awe-compelling as Ariaman, he exults and gleams like Surya. Varuna's commands are his commands. He too measures the earth's spaces and built the vault of the heavens. Like him, he too, full of wisdom, guards the community, watches over men even in hidden places, knows the most secret things. He will lengthen the life of the devout endlessly, and after death make him immortal in the place of the blessed, in the highest heaven. Soma. What is it? A crucial question arises in any discussion of this powerful plant on whose ecstatic visions all later Hindu religiosity is based. What was the botanical identity of Soma, the pillar of the world? In the 19th century, this question was nearly impossible to frame. The state of comparative philology was too rudimentary, and there was little impulse to adopt an interdisciplinary approach to the problem. Sanskritists did not talk to botanists, and neither talked to pharmacologists. In fact, to the 19th century, the question was uninteresting, rather like asking, "What song did the sirens sing?" or "Where is Troy?" Thanks to the discoveries of Heinrich Schliemann, who followed his own inner voices and promptings, it is generally agreed that we now know where Troy actually stood. And in that spirit of respect for the factual veracity of ancient texts, 20th century scholarship has attempted to decipher the botanical identity of Soma. These attempts have ranged from the casual to the exhaustive. The game is precisely the sort that scholars love to play. The answers must be contained in fragmented descriptions in a long-dead language filled with color words and words which only occur once in the literature of a given language. What plant best fits the scattered references to the physical form of this most mysterious member of the visionary flora? To answer this question, we must try to reconstruct the context in which the Indo-Europeans found themselves. One possibility is that the migrations, beginning sometime during the 6th millennium BC, carried the Indo-European tribes far beyond the forest environment suitable to the source of archaic Soma. Of course, events would have unfolded slowly. The archaic Soma must have been an item of trade between the original homelands of the Aryans and the frontiers of their southeastward expanding sphere of influence. Another possibility is that Soma was something that the Indo-Europeans did not come in contact with until they encountered the valley-dwelling pastoralists who presumably used mushrooms and who lived on the Konya plain of Anatolia. In either case, and over time, as linguistic differences arose, as trade routes became ever longer, and as local substitutes for Soma were experimented with and the local traditions of conquered people assimilated, the original identity of Soma became mingled with myth. Progressively more esoteric, it became a secret teaching, delivered orally and known but to a few, until finally it was forgotten. The preparation of visionary soma seems to be something that faded as the Indo-European migration ceased. At a time when reform and revitalization movements were being strongly felt in Persia, as well as on the subcontinent of India. Heoma and Zoroaster. Perhaps the disappearance of Soma occurred because the newly reform-minded religion of Zoroaster, established circa 575 BC, then holding sway on the Iranian plateau, had chosen to take a repressive approach to the ancient sacrament of godlike empowerment. Zoroaster told of Ahura Mazda, a supreme creator who creates through his own Holy Spirit and who rules over a world divided between truth and lies. The creatures of Ahura Mazda are free and thus responsible for their destiny. The outward symbol of truth is fire, and the fire altar is the center of Zoroastrian cultic practice. But as the following makes clear, the old allure of Soma was difficult to suppress. There are only two references to Heoma, Soma in the Gathas, or sacred verses of Zoroaster, one mentioning Duro Eosa, a verder of death, and the other alluding to the filthiness of this intoxicant. These allusions are sufficient to prove that the intoxicating Heoma was under the ban of the great reformer. But in the later Avesta, sacred book of Zoroastrianism, Heoma, like so many of the other old Deivas, gods, came back again, and according to Yasna 9-10, was in almost every respect the same as the Vedic Soma. Indeed, Zoroaster may not have actually intended to ban Heoma. Perhaps Zoroaster was merely objecting to the sacrifice of bulls, which was part of the rite. Bull sacrifice would certainly be anathema to anyone who is aware of the connection between cattle and mushrooms in the old religion of the great goddess. R.C. Zahner argues persuasively that Zoroaster never abolished the Heoma rite. In the Yasna, the Heoma is prepared for the satisfaction of the righteous Fravashi of Zoroaster. It is, of course, quite true that the Zoroastrians of what we have called the Catholic period brought back a vast amount of pagan material from the older national religion. So far as we can tell, the Heoma rite has been the central liturgical act of Zoroastrianism ever since that religion developed liturgical worship. And the central position it enjoys has never at any time been disputed. This is, however, not true of animal sacrifice. In later times, this was practiced by some but opposed by others. What clues are there that might guide us in the search for a botanical identity for Soma? In both the Veda and Avesta, the Soma plant is described as having hanging branches and a yellow color. Its mountain origin is also generally agreed upon. Soma substitutes had to be found once the tradition was forced underground on the Iranian plateau. Presumably, substitutes chosen would be similar in appearance to the original Soma plant. It is also probable that the technical terms of the ritual would be retained, even if the substitute plant did not correspond perfectly to Soma. Since the Soma rite was the essence of Vedic ritual, three daily pressings were necessary to worship the gods, which means large amounts of the plant would have been required. But most important, no plant could substitute for Soma if it were not itself an ecstatic visionary intoxicant worthy of being described in such extravagant terms as these. Where there is eternal light, in the world where the sun is placed, in that immortal, imperishable world place me, O Soma. Where life is free, in the third heaven of heavens, where the worlds are radiant, there make me immortal. Where there is happiness and delight, where joy and pleasure reside, where the desires of our desire are attained, there make me immortal. Heoma and Harmaline. Attempts to identify Soma have led to heated debates about, for example, the precise meaning of certain color words in the Vedic descriptions. Soma has been identified variously as an ephedra, a plant related to the plant that is the source of the stimulant ephedrine, a sarcostema, a relative of the American milkweeds, cannabis, and a leafless climber of the genus Periploca. It has also been identified as fermented mare's milk, fermented honey, or a mixture of these and other substances. Recently, Paganum harmala, the giant Syrian rue, which contains psychoactive substances, has been argued for very persuasively by David Flattery and Martin Schwartz in their intriguing book Heoma and Harmaline. They contend that the original identification of Vedic Soma with Syrian rue by Sir William Jones in 1794 was correct. They make their argument using the Zend Avesta and other scriptural materials of the Parsi religion that other scholars had passed over. In discussing the ordinarily invisible spiritual world of the afterdeath state called Menog existence in the Avestan religion, Flattery says this: "The consumption of Sama, Soma, may have been the only means recognized in Iranian religion of seeing into Menog existence before death. At all events, it is the only means acknowledged in Zoroastrian literature, and as we have seen, is the means used by Ormazd when he wishes to make the Menog existence visible to living persons. In ancient Iranian religion, there is little evidence of concern with meditative practice, which might foster development of alternative, non-pharmacological means to such vision. In Iran, vision into the spirit world was not thought to come about simply by divine grace or as a reward for saintliness. From the apparent role of Sama in initiation rites, experience of the effects of Sama, which is to say vision of Menog existence, must have at one time been required of all priests, or the shamans antecedent to them." The Wasson's Amanita Theory. Gordon and Valentina Wasson, the founders of the science of ethnomycology, the study of human uses of and lore concerning mushrooms and other fungi, first suggested that Soma might be a mushroom, specifically that it was the scarlet-capped, white-spotted fly agaric, Amanita muscaria, an extremely ancient shamanic intoxicant until recently used by the Tungusic tribes of Arctic Siberia. The evidence that the Wassons gathered was massive. By studying the evolution of the languages involved, tracing artistic motifs, and judiciously re-examining and reinterpreting the Vedic material, they made a strong case that a mushroom lay behind the mystery of Soma. Theirs was the first botanically sophisticated, pharmacologically informed inquiry into the identity of Soma. In other research, the Wassons discovered the existence of still active shamanic mushroom cults in the mountains of the Sierra Mazateca of Oaxaca, Mexico. Gordon Wasson brought samples of Mexican mushrooms to Swiss pharmaceutical chemist and LSD discoverer Albert Hoffman, and thus set the stage for the characterization and isolation of psilocybin in 1957, the same psilocybin that I argue is involved in the emergence of human self-reflection on the African grasslands some tens of millennia ago. In 1971, Gordon Wasson published Soma, Divine Mushroom of Immortality. There the case for fly agaric is presented in its most complete form. Wasson was brilliant in advancing the notion that a mushroom of some sort was implicated in the Soma mystery. He was less successful in showing that the species behind the mystery was the fly agaric. He, like all those before him who had attempted an identification of Soma, had forgotten that whatever Soma was, it was a visionary intoxicant of tremendous power and an unparalleled hallucinogen. In contrast, he was well aware that European scholarship had settled upon Siberian shamanism as exemplary of all archaic shamanism, and that fly agaric had long been used in Siberia to induce shamanic journeys and initiate neophyte shamans into the fullness of their heritage. As a result of Wasson's own discoveries in Mexico, it was known that mushrooms other than fly agaric could contain visionary intoxicants, but psilocybin mushrooms were thought to be a strictly New World phenomenon, since no other intoxicating mushrooms were known. Wasson assumed that if a mushroom were Soma, then that mushroom must be a fly agaric. This overemphasis of Amanita muscaria has haunted efforts to understand Soma ever since. Objections to fly agaric. Genetically and chemically, Amanita muscaria is extremely variable. Many kinds of fly agaric do not provide a reliable ecstatic experience. Soil considerations and geographic and seasonal factors also affect its hallucinogenic properties. Use of a plant by a shaman does not necessarily mean it is ecstatic. Many rather unpleasant plants are used by shamans to intoxicate themselves and to open the crack between the worlds. Among these are the daturas, relatives of jimsonweed, the arborescent brugmansias, whose pendulous blossoms are familiar as landscaping ornamentals, bright red and black Sephora secundifolia seeds, Brunfelsia, and Virola-based snuffs made of powdered tree resin. In spite of their shamanic usage, these plants do not induce an ecstatic experience that could inspire the rapturous praise heaped on Soma. Wasson himself was aware that Amanita was unreliable, as he himself never had an ecstatic experience from eating Amanita. Instead of realizing that Amanita muscaria was an unlikely candidate for Vedic Soma, Wasson became convinced that some method of preparation must have been involved. but no ingredient or procedure has ever been found that reliably transforms the often uncomfortable subtoxic experience of Amanita into visionary journeying to a magical paradise. Wasson himself knew of only one inexplicable and unreplicated exception. In 1965 and again in 1966, we tried out the fly agarics, Amanita muscaria, repeatedly on ourselves. The results were disappointing. We ate them raw on empty stomachs. We drank the juice on empty stomachs. We mixed the juice with milk and drank the mixture, always on empty stomachs. We felt nauseated and some of us threw up. We felt disposed to sleep and fell into a deep slumber from which shouts could not rouse us, lying like logs, not snoring, dead to the outside world. When in this state, I once had vivid dreams, but nothing like what happened when I took the psilocybe mushrooms in Mexico, where I did not sleep at all. In our experiments at Sugadaira, Japan, there was one occasion that differed from the others, one that could be called successful. Rokuya Imazaki took his mushrooms with miso shiru, the delectable soup that the Japanese usually serve for breakfast, and he toasted his mushroom caps on a fork before an open fire. When he rose from the sleep that comes with the mushroom, he was in full elation. For 3 hours he could not help but speak. He was a compulsive speaker. The purport of his remarks was that this was nothing like the alcoholic state. It was infinitely better, beyond all comparison. We did not know at the time why, on this single occasion, our friend Imazaki was affected this way. The chemical compounds active in Amanita muscaria are muscarine and muscimol. Muscarine is highly toxic, and like most cholinergic poisons, its activity is reversed by injection of atropine sulfate. Muscimol, the likely candidate for the psychoactivity of the mushroom, has been described as merely anemetic and a sedative. Human exposure to muscimol is not described in the literature. Incredibly, the obvious step of giving muscimol to human beings to determine its psychedelic potential, if any, has not been undertaken. This fact again points out the queasy illogic that overtakes the academic mentality in the presence of questions revolving around self-induced changes in consciousness. To the preceding, let me add my own personal experience of the fly agaric. I have ingested it on two occasions. Once the specimens were a dried collection made at sea level in Northern California. My experience of 5 dried grams was one of nausea, salivation, and blurred vision. Drifting images were present with eyes closed, but of a trivial and unengaging sort. My second exposure was a dinner plate-sized fresh specimen collected at 10,000 feet in the mountains behind Boulder, Colorado. In this case, salivation and stomach cramps were the only effects. Finally, here's part of an account of fly agaric intoxication by an extremely sophisticated subject, a professional psychotherapist and neurophysiologist. The dose taken was 1 cup of finely chopped mushroom. The mushrooms came from the Pecos River drainage of New Mexico. I was occasionally twitching, a gleam of perspiration over me, saliva dribbling rapidly out of my mouth. I did not know how the time passed. Thought I was awake or dreaming dreams that were totally lifelike, dreamed in total awareness. I was only dimly or not at all aware of the music being played. Threw off my blanket, very hot, sweaty, very cold-chilled but no visible chills. It seemed unusually quiet inside. I was very stoned. Unlike anything I had felt before, psychedelic is too broad a term, too all-encompassing. It was not truly psychedelic. It was as if everything were exactly the same but totally unfamiliar, but it all looked like I knew it to be. Except that this world was about a shade or a quantum level off, different in an eerie, profound, and unmistakable way. I was ataxic, unable to coordinate voluntary movements, and euphoric. There was very little visual stuff. In short, Amanita muscaria is doubtless an effective shamanic vehicle in the floristically limited Arctic environment in which it has been traditionally utilized as a psychoactive agent. But the rapturous visionary ecstasy that inspired the Vedas, and was the central mystery of the Indo-European peoples as they moved across the Iranian plateau, could not possibly have been caused by Amanita muscaria. Wasson, his contradictions and other fungal candidates for Soma. Wasson remained convinced that fly agaric was Soma. In his last book, Persephone's Quest, published posthumously, he characterized fly agaric as the supreme entheogen of all time, apparently on faith, since he admitted it was disappointing and only reported attaining shamanic ecstasy by using psilocybin, which he never introduces into the Soma puzzle. However, he did introduce an interesting caveat when writing of India. Other fungal entheogens grow at the lower levels. They come in cattle dung, are easily identified and gathered, and are effective, but they fail to conform to the Brahmanic practices. They are known to tribals and sudras, untouchables. Soma, on the other hand, exacts self-discipline of the priests, a long initiation and training. It is for proper exploitation, an affair of the priestly elite. But the possible role of Stropharia cubensis, growing in the dung of cattle in the lives of the lower orders, remains to this day wholly unexplored. Is S. cubensis responsible for the elevation of the cow to a sacred status, and for the inclusion of the urine and dung of cows in the Pankagavya, the Vedic sacrifice? And was that a contributing reason for abandoning Soma? Given the ecological conditions prevailing in the Indus Valley and Kashmir, only a few of the Indo-Europeans could know by personal experience the secret of the divine herb. The cult of Soma must have been shaped by the peculiar circumstances prevailing in the area, but ultimately those circumstances must have doomed that cult. Today it lives on in India only as an intense and glowing memory of an ancient rite. In discussing the prohibition against eating mushrooms if one is a Brahmin, a prohibition established in the late Vedic phase, Wasson says, "We still do not know. We will probably never know when the prescription came into force, perhaps over centuries while the Vedic hymns were being composed, or possibly when the hierarchs among the Brahmins learned of the entheogenic virtues of Stropharia cubensis, as known to the lower orders living in India." Something unusual is going on in these two passages. A great scholar, himself quite a Brahmin, an investment banker by profession, and an honorary fellow of Harvard University, seems to be behaving in a most unscholarly manner. We know from his own eloquent descriptions that Wasson experienced the ecstasy of psilocybin on more than one occasion. And we know that he never obtained a satisfying experience from Amanita muscaria. Yet in these passages he dismisses, ignores, and passes over ample evidence that the mushroom that lay behind the mystery of Soma was the psilocybin-rich Stropharia cubensis. He calls it easily identified and effective, but cannot conceive that it could be the Soma he seeks. He asks himself whether Stropharia cubensis could have been a contributing reason for abandoning Soma. Then he ignores his own question. If Soma is Stropharia cubensis, then the tradition could be traced unbroken back to prehistoric Africa. Twice in these two passages he refers to the lower orders, a break with his usual egalitarianism. My contention is that many considerations, some of them unconscious, shaped Wasson's words as he formulated his last statement on the problem that had consumed most of his life. Those who knew Wasson knew that he had a tremendous aversion to hippies, and that he was deeply troubled by the events that unfolded in Oaxaca after he published his findings on the mushroom cults that survive there. The predictable migration of adventurers, spiritual seekers, young people, and sensationalists that followed upon Wasson's revelations of the mushroom cults made him bitter and offensive on the subject of psychedelic culture. "I have often taken the sacred mushrooms, but never for a kick or for recreation. Knowing as I did from the outset the lofty regard in which they are held by those who believe in them, I would not, could not, so profane them. Following my article in Life, a mob of thrillmongers seeking the magic mushroom descended on Huatla de Jimenez. Hippies, self-styled psychiatrists, oddballs, even tour leaders with their docile flocks, many accompanied by their malls. Countless thousands elsewhere have taken the mushrooms, or the synthetic pills containing their active agent, and the chatter of some of them fills the nether reaches of one segment of our free press. I deplore this activity of the riffraff of our population, but what else could we have done?" Wasson maintained a position of stern disapproval of hedonistic use of his beloved entheogens, a clumsy word freighted with theological baggage that he preferred to the common term psychedelic. Perhaps it was this attitude that caused Wasson to decide that his magnum opus, written in collaboration with the French mycologist Roger Heim, Les Champignons Hallucinogènes du Mexique, should not be made available in the 1960s in an English translation. There could have been a host of reasons, of course. The fact remains that Wasson's most important work is his only work not available in English. Peganum Harmala as Soma. In fairness to Wasson, it must be said that he assumed that Stropharia cubensis was first encountered by the Indo-Europeans when they reached India, and thus that it entered the Soma equation rather late. My own contention is that Stropharia cubensis, or a conspecific coprophilic species, was well established in Africa, Anatolia, and perhaps the Iranian plateau millennia before the coming of the Indo-Europeans. This assumption changes the picture in important ways. It means that the invading Indo-European tribes encountered old mushroom-using cultures already in place on the Anatolian and Iranian plateaus. The increasing dryness of the region could possibly have prompted a search for mushroom substitutes long before the Indo-European invasions. I confess to being impressed by the new data on harmaline put forth by Flattery and Schwartz, arguing conclusively that, at least by late Vedic times, Aoma soma was understood to be Paganum harmala. Harmaline, the beta-carbamine present in Paganum harmala, is distinct in its pharmacological activity from harmine, its near relative which occurs in the South American ayahuasca plant, Banisteriopsis copi. It is known that harmaline is more psychoactive and less toxic than harmine. This may mean that Paganum harmala by itself, when brewed to sufficient strength, can give a reliable and ecstatic hallucinogenic experience. It certainly would be true that Paganum harmala in combination with psilocybin in any form would synergize and enhance the effects of psilocybin. Perhaps when mushroom supplies were low, this combination was used. Gradually, Paganum harmala might have come to supplant the ever-rarer mushrooms altogether. Here is an area where further research is clearly called for. Whatever the ultimate ethnopharmacological importance assigned to Paganum harmala, it is clear that before the Indo-European invasion, the cultures of Anatolia and Iran were of the Cattle Hayuk type. They were cattle-raising, great goddess-worshipping partnership societies practicing an orgiastic and psychedelic religion, the roots of which reach back toward Neolithic Africa and the emergence of self-reflecting consciousness. Soma as male moon god. The ninth mandala of the Rig Veda goes into great detail concerning Soma and states that Soma stands above the gods. Soma is the supreme entity. Soma is the moon. Soma is masculine. Here we have a rare phenomenon, a male lunar deity. It is limited to certain North American Indian peoples and to the Indo-Europeans, the German folk conception of the moon as masculine to this day. In studying folklore, the connection between the feminine and the moon is so deep and obvious that a lunar male deity stands out, making its traditional history in any region easy to trace. In the mythologies of the Near East, there is a lunar god that must have been imported to India from the West. The Babylonian civilization's northernmost outpost was the city of Haran, a city traditionally associated with the original home of Abraham and the beginning of astrology. The patron deity of Haran was a male moon god, Sin or Nannar. He was thought to have arisen from a god of nomads and a protector of cattle related to the masculine cult of the moon god in early Arabia. His daughter Ishtar in time overshadowed all the other female deities, as did her counterpart Isis in Egypt. As the father or source of the goddess, it is fitting that Sin wears headgear suggestive of a mushroom. No other deity in the Babylonian pantheon has this headgear. I found three examples of Sin or Nannar on cylinder seals. In each, the headgear was prominent, and in one instance, the accompanying text by a 19th-century scholar mentioned that this headgear was in fact the identifier for the god. Why was the Haran patron deity connected with a mushroom perceived as male? This is a problem for folklorists and mythologists. Yet it is clear that the Stropharia cubensis mushroom will take the projection of masculinity or femininity with equal ease. It is obviously connected to the moon. It has a lustrous silvery appearance in certain forms, and the overnight appearance of mushrooms in a field implies that they are active at night when the moon rules the heavens. On the other hand, one can shift the point of view and suddenly see mushroom as masculine. It is solar in color, phallic in appearance, and imparts a great energy, being traditionally thought of as the child of lightning. The mushroom is most correctly seen as an androgynous shape-shifting deity, which can take various forms depending on the predisposition of the culture encountering it. One can almost say that it is a mirror of classical expectations, and so for the Indo-Europeans took on a masculine quality, and in Saharan Africa and at Cattle Hayuk, a very lunar and feminine quality. In any case, it is a hallucinogen or a god that is not wild, that is associated with the domestication of animals and with human culture. Soma and cattle. The domestication of the mushroom can serve as the thread to specifically connect the dung-loving Stropharia cubensis mushrooms to Soma. That cattle are a major motif in the Soma cult makes little, if any, sense if one believes that Soma is Amanita muscaria. Wasson noted the association of cattle and Soma, but went to some lengths to avoid the logical conclusion that Soma must be a dung-loving species. So much emphasis is laid on cows in the Rig Veda and on the urine of bulls in the religion of the Parsis that the question naturally presents itself whether cows consume the fly agaric and whether they are affected by it, along with their urine and milk. I cannot answer this. Some 18 years later, Carl A.P. Ruck, in his contribution to Wasson's last published work, commented on the preceding passage in a footnote. Metaphors of cattle are also attributes of Soma, which can be described as an udder that yields the entheogenic milk and as a bellowing bull, the latter being apparently a characteristic of the mushroom that Perseus picked at Mycenae. The bull is the most common metaphor for Soma, and this manifestation of the sacred plant may underlie the tradition that Zeus, in establishing European civilization, abducted the Anatolian Europa by appearing to her in the form of a bull that breathed upon her the inspiration of the flower he had grazed upon. In order to save the hypothesis that Amanita muscaria is Soma, these authors have seized on the fact that the urine of reindeer and human beings who have eaten Amanita muscaria is itself a psychoactive material. Among the Siberian tribes where this fact was noted, the urine is preferred over the plant itself. But Amanita muscaria does not grow in grasslands, and cattle do not habitually graze on mushrooms, nor is there any reason to believe that if they did, their urine would have psychoactive properties, as the hallucinogens would probably have been metabolized. Wasson's doubts. Wasson himself was not as certain as his published statements might seem to indicate. In 1977, Wasson wrote the following in answer to my inquiry concerning the Stropharia versus Amanita question. Your question about Stropharia cubensis has also bothered me. When Roger Heim and I went to India in 1967, in the Simlipal Hills of Orissa, I was given an account of a mushroom growing in cow's dung that tallied perfectly with Stropharia cubensis, even to its psychoactive powers. My informant said that everyone avoided it. He seemed not to be withholding anything. He said he would deliver the mushroom to us, but though we stayed there a couple more days, I saw no more of him. Our purpose in going to India was altogether different. It will be necessary to pursue Stropharia cubensis further not only in India, but elsewhere in the world. Of course, Stropharia cubensis must flourish in India. Did it play a part in the abandonment of Soma? Inebriation from Stropharia cubensis and the other psilocybin species is clearly, in my opinion, superior to Amanita muscaria. I may develop this as one of several further ideas that I propose to include in my book next after this one, which I am now drawing to a close. Eventually, however, Wasson contradicted this position. A more plausible argument. As the arguments for Amanita being Soma are quite tortured, I believe the idea is best abandoned. The web of textual and linguistic associations that was so convincing to some can probably not be saved. Nevertheless, a more plausible reconstruction might run as follows. In their original homeland north of the Black Sea, the Indo-Europeans might well have practiced a shamanic religion with close similarities to the Amanita using shamanism characteristic of the Koryak, Chukchi, and the Kamchatal peoples of northeast Siberia. The Indo-Europeans were at that time surrounded to the north and the east by the Finno-Ugric peoples with a presumed long history of fly agaric use. In the 6th millennium BC, settled agricultural populations had already been present in Europe over 2,000 years, and urban civilizations were already ancient in the fertile river valleys of the Near East and the Anatolian Plain. Sometime in this millennium, the first extensive Indo-European colonization of the Asian steppes and desert areas began. On the Eurasian steppes north of the Black Sea, the Caucasus and the Taurus and the Zagros Mountains, the horse provided the key. If the domestication of cattle in Africa had set the stage for mushroom-using, goddess-worshipping partnership societies, among the Indo-Europeans the domestication of the horse reinforced mobility, male dominance, and a social economy based on rape and plunder. Wheeled vehicles, first invented on the fringes of the Caucasus where woodland and steppe meet, soon spread among the Indo-European tribes. With horse and chariot, they began moving west into the zone of established farming groups, east into Central Asia, and south toward Lake Van, where they encountered the urban cultures of the Anatolian and Iranian plateaus. These were cultures long in place and connected to a past that reached south and west to the cradle of consciousness in temperate African grasslands. Use of psilocybin was a folk practice as old as these cultures themselves. The Indo-Europeans. Whatever relationship the Indo-Europeans may have had to Amanita in their region of origin, it is most reasonable to suppose that the Vedas were written during the long centuries of their migrations toward the Indian subcontinent. These were centuries during which the Indo-Europeans subjugated and assimilated the valley pastoralists whom they conquered. From their contact with these cultures, the Indo-Europeans for the first time encountered the miracle of Soma and the awesome power in psilocybin. And while the Great Mother Goddess was suppressed in favor of the early Vedic pantheon and the partnership pattern was replaced by male dominance and patriarchy, still what was retained, exalted, and deified during the nomadic phase was the mushroom, now become Soma, thunderbolt of Indra. And though in earlier chapters I argued for psilocybin use in prehistoric Africa and Asia Minor, the evidence for this position is pictorial and circumstantial. It is not yet direct. A remarkable 2,500-year-old vessel with two grinning anthropomorphic mushrooms embossed on its surface found in Anatolia suggests that physical evidence of Middle Eastern mushroom use may soon emerge. Small mushroom-shaped objects carved from green stone have been found in Yugoslavia as well. As climatic conditions changed, and as the Indo-Europeans migrated farther and farther east, it is likely that the mild temperatures and grassland conditions required by Stropharia cubensis ceased to be available. Other mushrooms may have enjoyed use as soma substitutes, and of these, Amanita muscaria may have been preferred because of its availability in colder climes, its psychoactivity, however ambiguous, and its striking appearance. There are a number of possible problems with this theory. Primary among them is the lack of confirmation of the presence in India of Stropharia cubensis or other psilocybin-containing mushrooms. Amanita muscaria is also rare in India. I predict, however, that a careful search of the flora of India will reveal Stropharia cubensis as a common indigenous component of the biome of the subcontinent. The desertification of the entire area from North Africa to the region around Delhi has distorted our conception of what occurred when ancient civilizations were in their infancy and the area received higher rainfall. The psilocybin mushroom religion, born at the birth of cognition in the grasslands of Africa, may actually be the generic religion of human beings. All later adumbrations of religion in the ancient Near East can be traced to a cult of goddess and cattle worship, whose archaic roots reach back to an extremely ancient rite of ingestion of psilocybin mushrooms to induce ecstasy, dissolve the boundaries of the ego, and reunite the worshiper with the personified vegetable matrix of planetary life.